or visit will.illinois.edu/Illinois Radio Reader for more information. The Illinois Radio Reader is a service of Illinois Public Media.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We'd like to begin the program today by talking about a story that might have gotten missed under the weight of all the other news this week, and also, unfortunately, because of the sense that this kind of thing is becoming all too common. We are talking about another school shooting. There was another one in Troutdale, Oregon on Tuesday, where we understand that a 15-year-old high school freshman shot a 14-year-old fellow student, wounded a teacher, and then killed himself. That shooting, like the shooting at the UC Santa Barbara last month and others that have come so recently before those, is causing many people to ask if there is something about America's relationship with guns, the so-called gun culture, that's responsible for this. President Obama was one of the people asking that question. This is what he said after the shooting in Oregon.
We're the only developed country on earth where this happens. And it happens now once a week. And it's a one-day story. There's no place else like this.
We wanted to dig into that. We wanted to ask whether there is something unique about the U.S. and guns and gun violence, and if there is something that the U.S. can learn from other countries. So we've called upon Jukka Sevalainen. He is Associate Professor of Criminology at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. He's a former senior researcher at the Finnish Ministry of Justice. He's been studying this issue. He's with us from our bureau in New York. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Also joining us is Paul Barrett. He is senior feature writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. He's author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun, and he's been writing about gun use and gun violence for some years now and become a noted authority. Paul Barrett, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be here, Michelle.
He's also with us in New York. So, Professor Sevalainen, I'm going to start with you. One of the reasons we called you is that you've studied crime and criminal behavior both in Finland and the U.S., and the U.S. and Finland both have a high number of guns per capita. In fact, you know, the U.S. is number one, followed by Switzerland and then Finland. But the rate of gun violence is a lot lower in Finland, according to the World Health Organization. Could you just give us a couple of reasons why you think that is?
Absolutely. And it's interesting you mentioned Switzerland there, too, along with Finland. In Switzerland, the high gun ownership is kind of an artifact of their, one might call, quaint military system, which requires households to hold on to military rifles as a method of national defense. So, but also in Finland, most of the levels of gun ownership are indeed very similar in Finland and U.S. About 36-35% of the households have a firearm. But in Finland, as in Switzerland and many other countries, and even some states in the U.S. like Minnesota, the firearms tend to be hunting rifles. And moreover, they tend to be located in hunting cabins or vacation homes, which are plentiful in Finland and Scandinavia. Whereas in the U.S., the prevalence of handguns, which I think is the subject of the book of my my fellow Paul here, there's a dramatic difference. 22% of U.S. households have handguns compared to only 6% in Finland. And if you look at then the kind of etiology of gun violence in the U.S., it is 80% handguns. Hmm. And so basically a simple answer is this. If you have an argument, a dispute in a bar, or if you think about this recent incident in Florida, somebody is upset with loud rap music and so forth, and you have an altercation. In Finland, it doesn't really play into this altercation to have a hunting rifle 100 miles away. That doesn't become active, so to speak, as an instrument of violence. But in a culture where you have handguns in your car, it's a different matter.
Hmm. Paul Barrett, what do you think about that?
Everything you could just said sounds very sensible to me. And I think, you know, it's beyond dispute that the United States has a far higher rate of gun homicide than countries like Finland, Switzerland, or for that matter, countries that may seem even more similar to the United States, like Canada or Britain, where, I mean, for example, in Britain, the homicide rate per 100,000 is about one. In this country, it's 4.6, 4.7 in that neighborhood. So clearly, that's a significant multiple, and I think it's correct to say that we have much more lethal violent crime in this country than in comparable countries. And I think it's a fair deduction, although not so easy to prove in a strict cause and effect sense, but certainly a fair deduction, that the prevalence of firearm ownership in this country, and in particular the prevalence of handgun ownership, both legal and illegal, contributes to that higher rate of lethality. And well, I think those are all sort of basic facts that are beyond dispute.
Well, also, talking about Canada, for example, I mean, Canada has a high rate of gun ownership as well. But going to the broader question, you know, Paul, do you think there's something about the culture, the gun culture in this country that is dispositive? I just want to remember that, or is determinative of this. I mean, I'm thinking about the fact that the gentleman who became known in the 2008 election is Joe the Plumber. So the 2000 election is Joe the Plumber, who later went on to have kind of a career as a, you know, political candidate. You know, tweeted that after the Santa Barbara shooting and it's crude, and I apologize if this is hurtful to people, but he tweeted, you know, your dead kid doesn't trump my constitutional rights. I mean, one of the things that is unique about the United States is the Second Amendment. But other people make the point that there are other aspects of the Second Amendment that have been modified over the years about which people are not quite as draconian as that one. So could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, is there something about the culture or the way Americans feel about their guns that is different?
The short answer is yes, obviously. I think American gun culture is unique among this universe of comparable industrialized democracies that we tend to, the social scientists tend to look at as a group. I think the place to begin is where you mentioned, with the Second Amendment, which is a very unusual provision to have in a constitution, and which is more than a legally relevant provision, which it is, because it restricts the degree to which government can regulate gun ownership in this country. But it also is a reflection of cultural attitudes. The Second Amendment is not some strange concept bolted onto American culture. It is part of American culture. It has been there since the beginning, and it reflects in part the special role and the symbolism that many Americans, not all Americans, but many, attach to firearms. I mean, it is simply a function of our cultural history that since the founding of the country, some of our key images and our key ideas about what it means to be American are attached to firearms, ranging from the Minuteman in the Revolutionary era to the cowboys of the 19th century to the film noir detective of the early 20th century, all the way up to the gangster rapper of modern times. Guns are part of that picture. So yes, American culture is unusual, possibly even unique in that regard.
We only have about 4 minutes left, and I wanted to hear from both of you on this question. Is, you know, the president said that the country needs to do some soul searching about gun policy and about our feelings about guns, and I just wonder what that might look like. I know, Professor, it's Finland is such a different country. It's much less diverse than the United States. It doesn't have the history. For example, earlier gun control efforts in this country in the early days were directed at, you know, Native Americans and blacks to keep them from, you know, rising up against, you know, their oppressors, if you want to call it that. So is there anything, is there any evidence of, is there any history behind a change in attitudes about guns that you've been able to observe in your studies?
Well, those type of cultural facts are more difficult to study than percentages and so forth. But I guess I would address a little bit of the difference of Finland compared to the U.S. U.S. definitely is very different from Finland, but U.S. is also very different from U.S. in that there's a lot of regional variation. The homicide rate in Louisiana is 10 per 100,000. Homicide rate in New Hampshire is less than is in Finland. Homicide rate in Minnesota is equivalent to Finland. So maybe if they're soul searching, they could be even searching within the country and see what's producing this.
I think that's a vital point. We live in a very big country with multiple cultures, with varying attitudes toward violence, with varying attitudes toward how quickly one reaches for one's firearm, and with very different legal regimes. The laws here in New York City, where we're sitting, are very, very different from the laws in other big cities, Houston or New Orleans, and completely different from the regimes that exist in rural areas. So that's a very important thing. If you had a uniform level of gun violence in this country, I think people might actually be much more alarmed by these horrible incidents. But a lot of people say, you know, that doesn't happen in my in my area, my town is relatively safe.
So what would that soul searching look like, Paul Barrett? If this were to occur, is there any precedent for this happening in the United States? What would it look like?
I think the soul searching we ought to be engaging in right now is very focused and isn't about guns generally, but it's about this horrendous phenomenon that is now afoot in the land of the suicidal, murderous, deeply disturbed young man who clearly has a media and internet infused template at the moment for what to do when they decide to destroy themselves, which is to go and get mom and dad's gun, go to a school or a shopping mall, shoot some other people, and then kill themselves. And this is the phenomenon the president was talking about. Mm-hmm. And this is the phenomenon that's so deeply troubling to people. And I don't think actually gun control goes directly to addressing it. And I think we have to think about how we interrupt this process of the copycat 15 to 22-year-olds who are deciding to commit suicide by killing a bunch of people in a public space.
Clearly a very important topic, and we just only scratched the surface. So I thank you both so much for coming in to help us get started in thinking about this. Paul Barrett is senior feature writer at Bloomberg Businessweek and author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. Jukka Savolainen is associate professor of criminology at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, formerly a senior researcher at the Finnish Ministry of Justice. They were both kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Thank you both so much.
Sure. Thank you.
Coming up, former President George H.W. Bush, our 41st president, marked his 90th birthday yesterday by skydiving out of a helicopter. Lots of cameras were there, but a new documentary describes many of the private moments that shaped his character and his legacy.
If you want to take the measure of George Bush, look at the notes he has written people.
Columnist and former Bush speechwriter Mary Kate Carey talks the personal and political about our 41st president in her new film, 41 on 41. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional, licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Two locations, including inside the Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
British Army officer T.E. Lawrence was immortalized in the 1962 film Lawrence of Arabia. On the next Fresh Air, Scott Anderson, author of Lawrence in Arabia, tells us how the real Lawrence prepared himself for greatness even as a boy.
He would try to stay awake for days at a time. He would deny himself food, deny himself water, for as long as he could physically endure.
Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Former President George H.W. Bush turned 90 years old yesterday, and I think it's fair to say that he celebrated in a way that most 90-year-olds do not, by skydiving near his summer home in Kennebunkport, Maine. The 41st president's legacy is also being celebrated with the new documentary 41 on 41. The film dives into the president's personal life and political life with 41 people who know him best, his children and grandchildren, former aides, columnists, and other former presidents. The film airs this Sunday on CNN, and here to tell us more is the executive producer, who is none other than our own Mary Kate Carey. She is a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush, and she joins us often to talk about politics and the power of words. Welcome back, Mary Kate. Thanks so much for joining us. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I've been looking forward to this day for a long time.
This was your idea.
Yes, it was. I lost my father when I was in my early 20s, and shortly after that, I became a speechwriter for George Bush, and I started picking up stories from him and lessons from him, a lot of which are in this film. And I wanted to figure out a way to get those stories to other young people and learn all the things about his good humor and his character and his integrity. And as I got older and worked for him longer, I realized there were a lot of people with great stories like mine. I thought there must be some way to sort of magnify the narrative, as they say, and tell it in a way that was bigger than just me.
The film does two things. It talks a lot about who he is as a person, and it does talk a lot about his political style. So I just want to start with the politics, and I just want to play a clip from his early political life as a congressman in Texas. He voted in support of the 1968 Fair Housing Act at a time when a lot of people in his district did not necessarily cotton to this. And I just want to play a short clip from Susan Baker. She is the wife of course, James Baker, one of the president's oldest friends and closest political allies. He was a former Secretary of State, former Secretary of the Treasury. And this is Susan Baker talking about the issue. Here it is.
George Bush got a lot of flack from his district. There was still a lot of bigotry and a lot of discrimination in Texas and the South, because people wanted to be able to exclude people from neighborhoods if they were not of their same race or their same creed. And this law was going to abolish that and make that illegal. And he just said, I'm going to support it regardless of the fallout.
Susan Baker also goes on to make the point that he did lose donors and he did lose some support because of that. Why did you want to include this story?
I liked it because we heard the story from so many people in different interviews. Roger Ailes knew about it. Bill Clinton remembers being in Arkansas and noticing a young freshman congressman from Texas who voted in favor of the open housing law. Mrs. Baker was there in Texas and saw it on the ground, saw the donors pull out. We were able to have parallel stories that kept going later in the documentary where he did the same thing, whether it was the 1990 budget deal or the not dancing on the Berlin Wall when it fell. He was always choosing to do what he thought was right rather than what was politically popular.
One of the points that people make over and over again, he's a really nice person. You know, it's just not a quality that people associate with political leaders. And you interview people who are White House butlers, the Secret Service agents who protected him, fishing buddies and people like that. But I think one of the more touching stories is one that's told by his grandson, Pierce, who had crashed his boat. And anybody knows, the president knows, that he really loves that boat. And not just that, on the same weekend, he took his grandmother's car, Mrs. Bush's car, without her permission. And she did not appreciate that and made her thoughts known. He was in his early 20s at the time, but he was so upset that he was crying. And so he said that he went to his room and there he found a note from his grandfather. And here's that clip.
Pierce, I remember days when I felt I could do nothing right. But then the sun would come up and a bright day would embrace me. Do not worry about the boat or car incidents. You are a good man who got a bad bounce, but all is well. Believe me, I hate to see you worrying and down. You brighten my life, so forget yesterday and today's little, and he underlined little, incidents. You the man, and I love you. Gandy does too, Gampy.
He still seems like he wants to cry.
Yeah, he was close. He was close.
And he's reading the note. He had it in his pocket.
Yeah.
I mean, he talks about how he has kept that note. You had a whole sequence in the film about those notes. The man seemed like he was writing notes all day long.
In the midst of pandemonium, he would sit down and dash off notes to people. We could have made an entire documentary of nothing but people reading us just like this, pulling them out of their pockets, notes from George Bush. David McCullough, the great historian, we interviewed him, and he said, if you want to take the measure of George Bush, look at the notes he has written people, and that will tell you the story of his life. When Barack Obama talked to us, he said, George Bush has this reputation, like you were saying, Michelle, for being such a nice guy. And the notion is, how did a nice guy get to be president of the United States?
One of the points, though, that you make in the piece is that that desire to use kind of personal kindness was not just for his family, but was also a tool of diplomacy. Now, you know, some people feel like that's not the way it's done, right? That's just, some people think that's naive. Like, what do you mean, like, your personal friendships are so relevant, you know? So who cares? I just wanted to ask what you came away with after having reported this piece. I mean, what do you think?
Bob Gates told us that by the time he came into office, he had an international web of people all over the world who had become his friends through things like you're saying, these sort of, hey, how's the weather today sort of phone calls. And yet when the chips were down, they were always going to do what was in their national best interest, but they were willing to sign on to, say, the coalition in the first Persian Gulf War because they knew George Bush and they trusted him. And they were doing things out of friendship for him if it aligned with their national best interest. And I think that's what we are not seeing right now. Just the other day, the European Parliament contacted me to see if there was something we could do together with this, to show this in Europe for the countries to work together within the EU. I was very touched by that. I you know, that's the kind of thing people can learn from George Bush, I think, is his ability to use personal diplomacy to affect a greater outcome for peace in the world.
Well, this film very much has a point of view. I mean, the fact is you are a former speechwriter for President Bush. She's somebody who is clearly very dear to you. Tell us what it is you're trying to accomplish with this film, in addition to showing the president and his family how much you appreciate him, of course.
I'm trying to get across that it's not quaint or naive to treat people decently, to behave with integrity, to have good humor as you go through life. That's the way forward in Washington for the next generation. And to have people who are committed to public service like he was and to treating all people, whether they're the White House butler or the Queen of England, the same, that's the way forward in Washington. And I think that's the kind of future that young people deserve rather than what we've got going on right now where, you know, nobody's talking to each other.
Mary Kate Carey was a speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush, Bush 41. She is the executive producer of the new film 41 on 41. It's about his life and legacy. The film airs this Sunday on CNN. Thank you, Mary Kate Carey. I know that you're up in Kennebunkport helping the president celebrate his 90th birthday. So
yes.
I hope you'll convey our best wishes to him.
I would be happy to do that. He's doing great. So thank you.
And now we'd like to take a moment to remember Ruby Dee, the legendary actress and activist, died Wednesday at the age of 91. She was a veteran of both stage and screen, and she made an impact on art lovers across the generation, starting with her role as Ruth Younger in the 1961 film A Raisin in the Sun, later in Do the Right Thing, and 2007's American Gangster, for which she was nominated for an Oscar at the age of 83. Her impact went far beyond her own roles. She served as an inspiration to a number of actors, particularly Black performers, who viewed her as a role model. One of them was Tony Award winner Felicia Rashad. We reached Felicia Rashad this morning, and she told us how much she appreciated Ruby Dee for her work in the world.
This was a woman who lived consciously. It was her deep conviction that everyone belonged to everyone else. She was not afraid to speak truth to power. She was unafraid.
Other performers took to social media. Actress Jada Pinkett Smith said the following on Facebook, "I lost a cherished friend yesterday. Rest in peace, Ruby Dee. Thank you for the gifts you shared with the world, and thank you for the time and wisdom shared with me. But most importantly, thank you for the care you always showed me. I miss you already." Samuel L. Jackson tweeted, quote, "We lost a jewel today. Mrs. Ruby Dee, so great, so love. Rest in peace. All sympathy to her family." I had the chance to speak with Ruby Dee back in 2007, around the time her film American Gangster appeared, and we thought you'd like to hear part of that conversation again. So here it is.
My dream was I was going to be an actor. Racism occurred to me. It dawned on me that I would not be an actor. It occurred to me that I was not white. It occurred to me that being what they call colored, being a Negro, was some kind of a disadvantage. All those things I knew as a kid, and that at one of these days I was going to run away. And my first heroes were Franchot Tone and Robert Taylor and because I didn't know any black screen idols, you know, that I see today.
What did your parents think of your plan to become an actor? At some point, people didn't think that was a terribly respectable way to earn a living. What did they think about it?
Oh, well, my mother, my stepmother, really, she herself had been what they call an elocutionist. And she was the one who first encouraged me to write poetry because she used to read it to us. And then when I began to write, when I was 9 years old, my first poem was published in the Amsterdam News. I called it The Graveyard. Can you imagine? That was my first poem. It's so quiet and lonely, a place for dead people only. Too late to live when all they had to give is laid beneath the sod. And they published it. That was my very first poem.
And it was while you were at Hunter College, wasn't it, that you joined the American Negro Theater?
Yes.
Which is where you met, you know, Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte.
Yes, those were the days.
Mm-hmm. And theater is how you met your husband, yes?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was with another group similar to the one that I was part of called the Rose McClendon Players, and they were looking for a young man, a soldier, to do the lead in this play called Jeb. And that's how I happened to meet Ossie at a rehearsal. You know, this long, gangly man that kind of spilled along, you know, sort of like all bones and an Adam's apple, you know. That's how I happened to meet Ossie.
Well, what did you like about Ossie Davis when you first met him?
I thought he looked very hungry. he looked so poverty-stricken or something. I think that's what I was thinking, because he had on clothes that didn't fit him. But he had a very nice smile. So he knew about hunger. He knew about suffering. He knew about riding the rails and tramping through cities, getting somewhere. And it was in the days when a lot of people slept in the park. And he was one of them. But that didn't seem to bother him. I told him, I said, oh, Ossie, you only did that because it's romantic, you know. And he was a poet, too, a poet sleeping in the park, you know.
I wanted to talk about a role for which many people of a certain age surely know you, and that is from Raisin in the Sun, and I want to play a short clip.
I'm trying to talk to you about myself. And all you can say is eat them damn eggs and go to work.
You never say nothing new. I listen to you every day, every night, and every morning, and you never say nothing new. So you would rather be Mr. Arnold than be a chauffeur. So I would rather be living in Buckingham Palace.
That is just what is wrong with the colored woman in this world. Don't understand about building their men up, making them feel like they're somebody, like they can do something.
There are colored men who do things.
No thanks to the colored woman.
Well, being a colored woman, I guess I can't help myself none.
When you hear that, now, when you think about that role now, how does it make you feel?
Oh, I'm impressed with Lorraine Hansberry. She was a genius at whose feet I could sit. But I had questions, you know, and although I loved Raisin in the Sun, as I look back, so many things occur to me, and the reality mixes with the story, because I remember when we, Ossie and I, got married and we wanted to move into a little house we bought. And a friend of mine, a white friend of mine, called me and said, Ruby, you don't want to move there. He said, there's so many black people over there already. Why don't you move out so-and-so-and-so where it's not integrated yet? I didn't care about being integrated or accepted. And that was the one thing that bothered me about being in Raisin in the Sun. But as I grew older and began to work in the civil rights movement and became, quote, an activist, I don't remember when I really wasn't, you know.
Well, talk to me, if you would, about your... what you call your quote-unquote activism. I'm wondering why you put it that way, because some people have shied away from social activism, fearing that it would hurt their careers. Whereas you and your husband were both close friends of Martin Luther King Jr. You were both MCs for the 1963 March on Washington. Ossie Davis gave the eulogy at Malcolm X's funeral. Did you ever fear that your activism would harm your ability to work?
I'm thinking, in all honesty, I never thought about myself as an activist when I was coming along. I wasn't a joiner. You know, I love the people I love. I didn't care what they could be, Democrat, Republican, communist, you know, and anything but a racist, you know.
But I do want to ask if you were ever afraid. You grew up in a time when leaders were being cut down. Martin Luther King was killed. Robert F. Kennedy was killed. Malcolm X was killed. All people you knew. And you did have fellow artists who lost their livelihood because of their political involvements. Were you ever afraid?
No, not personally afraid, because nothing in my background surprised me. The white folks weren't getting lynched. We felt sorry for those people who were being abused, but they were just tasting a little teeny bit of what was racism and fascism and the horror of what was happening in the country.
You have your own body of work, but you also had this incredible partnership with Ossie Davis over, you know, almost 60 years together. I just wonder what it's been like for you to carry on without him.
Oh, my. I can't say it's been difficult, because he left me so much. And also, I keep thinking every time I feel something well up in me that feels like it could mature into a tear or something, I have to stop it, because he was very fond of saying, can't fix it, ain't found it. Well, you got to down it and get from around it. You know, he wasn't the mourner, you know. And I don't know. I have to keep on keeping on.
How would you like to be remembered?
If I could be, somebody could think of me and feel encouraged, I'd like to be remembered. It's in those little flashes of moments, I think, that we remember each other, that pick us up from some moments of despair. That's how I'd like to be remembered, in the recollection, to make the moment more bearable, if not enjoyable.
That was the legendary actress and activist Ruby Dee speaking with us back in 2007. She died this week at the age of 91. Coming up, 20 years ago this week, Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman were killed at her Southern California home. The crime led to the trial of Simpson's husband, O.J. It became known as the trial of the century, the O.J. trial.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
As we know, the glove did not fit, and some people still think the verdict didn't either. The Barbershop Guys weigh in on the lasting legacy of the O.J. Simpson trial. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves target bank and savings accounts of victims. Learn more at LifeLock.com, code NPR. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The world's only wooden whaling ship has been restored and is about to set sail, but this time as a floating museum to teach people about whales, not to hunt them.
That's your cargo today. It's history. Some of them are inspiring and exciting. Some of them are terrible that we need to remember so that we don't repeat.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
A political stunner as House Majority Leader Eric Cantor is defeated by an unknown underfunded challenger. Mr. Cantor actually spent more money at steakhouses than his opponent spent on his entire campaign. So while Cantor won't have a job, he will have three doggy bags filled with leftover bloomin' onions. I'm Peter Sagal. We're looking for the bright side of all kinds of bad news on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday at 10 a.m. and Sunday at noon on AM 580.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, celebrating 26 years of fair trade. 10,000 Villages creates opportunities for artisans in developing countries to earn income by bringing their products and stories to our markets through long-term fair trading relationships.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel with us from Cleveland. In our Washington, D.C. studios, we have Paul Butler. He is a law professor at Georgetown University. From NPR West, which is in Culver City, California, film writer, actor, and producer Rick Nahara. We hope to connect to Arsalan Iftikhar, founder of themuslimguide.com in Chicago. We're having a little trouble connecting with him, but we hope he'll be joining us. That being said, take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. First, props for that nice piece on Cleveland's own Ruby Dee. You know, she made her bones here. She made her bones here at Cleveland's Caramu Theater, the oldest Black American theater in America. May she rest with the angels. Everybody,
yeah.
Welcome to the shop. How we doing?
What's up?
Good, good. Good to be here.
All right, well, let's get things started. The San Antonio Spurs absolutely iced the Heat last night in Game 4 of the NBA Finals. Even the king, Miami's LeBron James, by way of Akron, seemed humbled by the 107-86 loss. Can we drop that tape, please?
I mean, they smashed us. Two straight home games, got off the awful starts. You know, they came in and you know, was much better than us in these two games. It's just that simple.
Yes, yes, it is, LeBron. But, you know, that puts the Miami Heat down 3-1 games in the series. No team has ever, and I mean with a capital E, come back from a deficit that far down in the finals. Paul Butler, Prince Paul, what are the guys, what are the old guys doing right?
Let's hear it. Let's hear it for the old heads on the San Antonio Spurs. This is generational. This is epic. It's gritty versus glitzy. I don't like dynasties in professional sports, so it's just enjoyable to see this dynasty fail. And my mom says I look like Tim Duncan.
Oh, well, okay.
Well, and mom's always right.
I think you're much more handsome than Tim Duncan.
Well, thank you, Michelle.
So. Hey, now.
And enough with the haterade. Rick, go ahead. That being said, enough with the haterade.
Yeah, enough with the haterade.
Yes.
I think it's pretty much a done deal. It's a done deal. It can't come back after that.
Don't agree. Well, Jimmy, what do you think?
I think that if anybody can bring it back, it is LeBron. But I don't think LeBron is about that life. I think he might be a natural born loser. I mean,
he's got two rings, yo. How many you got?
I got the one that matters. But what I'm suggesting to you is that he chokes at the point, and you have to be a finisher in life, in this game. That's just the way of it, and I don't know if he's about that life. I just think he doesn't like the pressure. He likes the glam. He likes the pop bottles. He likes the win, but he doesn't like the pressure of that can come with the win. So I don't know.
Well,
come on, man.
Thank you, Arsalan.
Yeah.
Step up.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, A-Train. Say what you got to say, bro.
Listen, I'm rooting for the San Antonio Spurs, but as long as LeBron James is in any playoff series, this ain't over until the Spurs seal the deal. It's been an incredible series so far. The fact that the Spurs were able to spank the Heat twice at home in Miami. They need to go back to San Antonio. They need to finish it off right now. And, you know, if they're able to finish off the Heat, the NBA Finals MVP is going to be none other than who, what, where, when, Kawhi Leonard. That man has been balling like a grown man. It's been a pleasure to watch.
You know, what's been interesting to me, though, is that people celebrate, you know, LeBron for his physicality, but I've been really interested in how he's analyzed each game. I've really enjoyed listening to how he analyzed each game, and he talked about how you have to keep your eye on every man up until the 24th second. You can't play for 20 seconds. It's got to be for the 24th. I've just sort of learned a lot from listening to him kind of analyze the game, but it is interesting to me, like, how it is that you can't, that they haven't been able to execute. I just find that I don't really understand that, Paul, do you?
Yeah, I mean, LeBron is growing. I mean, he's growing into his grown man self. And what I like about him is not just in basketball, but in life. I mean, he's one of the most political of all the NBA speakers. He was one of the first to speak out against Sterling. He was down with the Florida case. So, Matt, props for that.
All right, we'll kick it over to the soccer field.
Yeah,
Jimmy.
A-Train, Arsalan, you have to be the only American-born dude I know who watches World Cup 24/7. What's
Come
up with
on,
that, bro?
Man.
Seriously, Real talk. No, see, real talk.
The World Cup is it's the unifying factor for the world. You know, it happens every 4 years. It has taken over for the Olympics as sort of the globalist Coca-Cola moment. And you know, it started out great. And, you know, the first day you had Brazil and Croatia, and which was a tight game until a very controversial penalty call, which resulted in a penalty kick, and Brazil was able to take the game against Croatia. It's going to be really interesting to see if they're going to be able to win, being the host country. But you know, you have teams like Spain and Germany and other powerhouses. It's going to be a fantastic, fantastic few weeks of the World Cup.
Is it? Can I ask Arsalan? Is it harshing your mellow at all that there have been so many street demonstrations? I mean, obviously, yeah. There was a lot of talk up until the Olympics in Russia, the Sochi Winter Olympics, that there was a lot of unhappiness there with the way this whole thing proceeded. I mean, the amount, the expense, all the people who've been cleared out of their houses. But it seemed like once the games got started, people kind of rally to it, and that does not seem to be the case here at all. And I just wondered, is it kind of diminishing your enjoyment of the whole experience that people are so angry that there's been so much violence? And so,
no, you're absolutely right, Michelle. And you know, it hits the nail on the head about these major world events like the World Cup or the Olympics, where essentially these host countries build these gigantic multi-billion-dollar stadiums, which then become white elephants after these events are over and are essentially empty. And those multi-billion dollars could be used for healthcare, education, employment programs for these host countries. And it shows, I mean, Brazil, it, you know, the religion of Brazil is soccer. And the fact that they are willing to, you know, essentially forsake their religion for the betterment of their own people on the streets really shows that they have their priorities straight as a society.
But you're still watching. Anybody else care? Anybody else? Paul doesn't care. Rick, you care?
Well, Rick, you down with CUP?
Yeah. I'm down with looking at this thing going, they spent $11 billion in Brazil for these soccer. That's like a ghetto father spending all his money on a big screen TV when they're evicting him. I mean, that's just wrong. So it's hard for me to enjoy the game the same way, even though I will enjoy the game. You know, I predict Brazil will win. They'll have to win, else there'll be really big riots. There'll be the double riots.
How about that? It's an interesting question. It kind of reminds me of the conversations we have a lot about football. Because on the one hand, you're a fan and you love the game, and then you start thinking about the impact that it has and how, right. You know, how are you supposed to put all that together. I mean, it's not a small question. So anyway,
and just to point out, by football, Michelle, you meant real football. I hate when they call that game soccer or football. Football is 300-pound dudes trying to knock each other down.
That's to you.
No jingoism there.
American.
No,
yeah, I know,
jingoism,
right?
There. Yeah, that's excuse me.
Yeah, well, I hate to say it. They call it football. it's pronounced a little bit differently. But I think it is a world sport. I mean, this is every four years. This is amazing. And this is a unifying fact for the world. More people watch this than the Super Bowl and everything else combined. This is it.
It is kind of weird, though. It's the biggest youth sport, you know, in America by far. You know, millions of kids play soccer, and somehow it just doesn't translate into the adult world. I don't know.
You know, it's going to translate, because right now all those kids are a new generation. I'm watching my own son, Julian, is a soccer star. All he talks about is soccer. And he's wearing a Mexico jersey right now because Mexico's playing.
Well, I have a theory, and I'll just throw it out there, and then we'll move on, which is that my theory is that the advent of the big screen, you mentioned big screens earlier, Rick, that I think the advent of the big screen is going to enhance our appreciation of it, because you can see the whole field. And I just feel like that's what you need. You need to see the whole field to really feel the game. Yeah. That's just my theory, and I could be wrong.
No, I think you're right, because it's a youth, it's the younger generation that's going to look at soccer in a whole different way than the older generation is. So I think it's just going to grow.
You mean like Grouchy Paul?
if
you're just joining us, we're having our weekly Barbershop Roundtable with writer Jimmy Israel, Professor Arsalan Iftikhar, film and television writer and producer Rick Nahara, and law professor Paul Butler. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay, well, TMZ breaks a lot of big stories, but no one ever called it ethical journalism. Still, some folks are petitioning the website to take down a video of the crash scene involving comedian Tracy Morgan, Michelle.
Well, that's right. Many people will remember that Tracy Morgan and five others were heading back from a comedy gig last Saturday night when a Walmart truck struck their limo bus. One person died. Morgan and a number of others were badly injured. The daughter of one of the injured New Jersey comedian Artie Fuqua has asked TMZ to take the video down, and saying on Instagram, "They don't understand how hurtful it is to see my father be dragged out of the wreckage along with all the other false information on his condition. I understand people want to know and people want to be updated, but enough is enough." So, Jimmy, I'm interested in your take on this, because you're kind of a First Amendment absolutist. On the other hand, you're also a human being and feel that, you know, what about that?
I think entertainment news is dicey at best, but if you're going to do it, then you have to do it right. And the Zapruder film is available, and that is a most unfortunate recording. So if that's available for us as the general public to check out, and
he's the president of the United States. That's a little different, isn't it? You don't think that's
I think journalism is journalism. I think if you're going to do it, then you have to do it right. Hashtag Wham reference. You know, I mean, okay. that's just my feeling.
Sure. All right, Rick, what do you think as a person who's kind of in the world too, where celebrities are often like, that's the whole trick, is to get celebrities into a position that's uncomfortable or not flattering or whatever.
We live in a reality world. I mean, come on, I live in the TMZ area. You know, I was just walking down Rodeo Drive, and there was a little white kid next to me, and a black man actually walked by, and the kid looked and said, "Is that Seal?" I mean, to me, that is all about celebrity. She assumed it's Seal. It was a black man, just a regular black man, and she thought it was Seal. And I look at that, and I go, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, when you look at journalism, like when you see Robert Kennedy shot and a busboy holding his head with a rosary, it's powerful journalism. That's a very powerful photograph. And in some ways, when you look at TMZ, and they're like the National Enquirer of what journalism would be. So in some ways, I think it's a double-edged sword. If you want to live by celebrity, you're going to die by celebrity too. I mean, you are in an open field. And some people might look at – I looked at the same footage of him being – a man being dragged out of that wreckage and thinking, oh, good, he's getting medical aid. That made me feel better. Actually, I didn't see it as exploitive, although I'm sure it was.
Okay. Paul, what do you think?
This is getting a little too highbrow for me. People like looking at gross stuff. When I heard about this video, I rushed to the TMZ site and I peeped it. You know, there's this Andy Warhol series called Car Wreck, and I saw it at an exhibit, and people were leaning in. They were like, is that blood over there? Is that a body part? There's something about inspecting the gruesome that's cathartic. It quenches some base emotion that we have.
Arsene, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we live in a completely voyeuristic society now. You know, with the ubiquitousness of smartphone videos, you know, we sometimes citizen journalists, you know, get stories and scoops before CNN is able to. And I think here, you know, this is a double-edged sword of celebrity. You know, I think if Tracy Morgan wasn't a famous person, if it was a Jeffrey Morgan who had gotten into this car wreck, I don't think anybody would be calling for this video to be removed. Let's not forget.
Well, they might,
you know,
though.
In 1994, when Tupac was shot, right, the autopsy photos of Tupac with the bullet holes, you know, they made it into our zeitgeist as well. You know, this is just, you know, an unintended consequence of our voyeuristic society now.
Well, you know, that there are some people, speaking of which, this is the last thing I wanted to talk about today, and I wanted to save some time to talk about that. There are those who think that this kind of started in the modern era. I mean, gossip has always been among us, you know, passing rumors, wanting to know people's business, that has always been among us. But this idea that we should be able to look at this stuff 24/7, a lot of people think that started with the O.J. trial. There was nonstop coverage of the O.J. Simpson trial. It's 20 years ago. Even if you wanted to avoid it, you couldn't. I don't know. What do you all think about that? Do you think that this thing has a lasting impact? Do you credit that theory? I mean, Jimmy, do you want to start?
I'm scared to talk about the OJ trial only because I think what you're saying is true, and I think everything, both good and bad, we say about the OJ trial is true. I think it was a moment in American history where you got to learn that your white neighbor wasn't as liberal as you thought he was, and the white neighbor learned that there was something about Black American justice and justice that he didn't know. Almost everybody Black I know knows that OJ did it, and it wasn't even the point. The point was that for everybody that didn't do it, they got set up for the Emmett Teals, for everybody, for the James Byrds, for the people that James Byrd doesn't count. I'm just saying people that were robbed of justice. Mm-hmm. You know, OJ bought himself justice, and it was for a moment. It was good to see a Black man be able to have enough money in his pocket to buy the kind of justice he wanted, whether he deserved it or not, certainly a different question.
Paul, what do you think?
And I think white people are listening to Jimmy and asking, what planet does this man live on? So I think the case created this cynicism about race relations that's still very present in our culture. And in fact, part of what was so appealing about Barack Obama was the hope that he could bridge that gap. And we see how well that worked out.
What do you think, Rick? You're out there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I look at it this way. I guess I'm in the middle brown side on this one, because, you know, as Latinos, we really felt that we knew that people of color didn't get the best justice, and normally you needed the best legal team for it. The trial proved that to everyone beyond belief. And then I think for white people, it was what you said, is that they were surprised that, wow, justice is blind and can be influenced. It was without a doubt. And it was unfortunate because the moral thing was, is most of us believed he was guilty, and I still do.
You know, it's interesting, though, people forget that the data show that, forgive me, I don't remember the Latino number, I remember that 2/3 of African-Americans thought he was innocent and 1/3 thought he was guilty, and it was reverse. It was 2/3 of whites surveyed thought he was guilty and 1/3 thought he was innocent. But that's 1/3 thought he was innocent. And the number of white people who thought he was innocent as a number would exceed the number of black people who thought the same. You see what I'm saying? So that's a lot of people. And somehow those people are all disappeared in this conversation. There were a lot of different opinions about this. And somehow that seems to have been lost. Arsene, you get the final thought here briefly, if you would.
You know, as a lawyer myself, I know Paul Butler is a lawyer also. The O.J. Simpson trial was the first time in my life where it was sort of this watershed moment for me where I realized that what Jimmy said, that people who are rich in America, regardless of your color, can afford the legal team needed to get people off. If he was a poor white man, I think he would have been found guilty. If he was a poor black man, I think he would have been found guilty. If he was a poor brown man, I think he would have been found guilty. I think the O.J. Simpson trial showed America that if you're rich enough to afford the legal team, they can get you off.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's on a happier note, let me just say happy Father's Day to the fathers. Let me say happy 90th birthday to George H.W. Bush. And since he jumped out of a plane on his 90th birthday, I will be expecting no less for the rest of you who are who have not yet achieved that number. Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. Rick Nahara is a film and television writer and actor and producer. Arsalan Iftikhar is founder of themuslimguy.com and an adjunct professor of religious studies at DePaul University. Paul Butler is a law professor at Georgetown University. Thank you all so much.
Peace.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.